were throwing up in the streets out of sheer terror. Then three Soviet cruise missiles hit three French military bases with poison gas warheads. The French were preparing a counterstrike, so the history books say. I have my doubts. Most of those texts were written by Russians. No. Perhaps I exaggerate, Kvistikart said, dryly enough to let the young aide know that he did not believe so. But there was no other fighting. There was no nuclear war. Of course not. With the Americans humbled and Western Europe groping in the dark, there was no need for fighting. The Soviets had made their point. Paris, London, even Bonn fell all over themselves in their eagerness to make their accommodations with the new political situation. The Cold War ended almost overnight. And now you see the result. Things are getting better. So I am told. Gazing up and down the wide boulevard, the two men saw a dark, wet, chilly, empty street. A steam-powered bus chuffed by, lumbering and lurching. The sidewalks were bare of people except for a couple of stocky men in long gray raincoats hurrying along. They looked like Russians to Kvistikart. The Americans, the young man whispered, almost as if he were talking to himself. It's their fault. They abandoned Europe. They left us defenseless. Yes, that's true. But they made themselves defenseless first. Once the Soviets established anti-missile weapons in space, the American nuclear forces became rather useless. But why? How could they have been so blind? Kvistikart lifted his glass again, only to find that it was empty. No waiter was in sight. The Americans got tired, he said. They shouldered the burdens of the world for almost a century. And then they got tired of the job. They tried to take the easy way out. They never felt comfortable about world leadership. In their hearts, all they wanted was for the rest of the world to like them. Like little puppy dogs. All they wanted was to be petted and told that they were good. They made several very poor decisions, and before they realized what had happened, the Soviets had a decisive military advantage over them. The anti-missile satellites. That was the straw that broke the Americans' back, Kvistikart agreed. But I think they were relieved to quit the race. I honestly think so. They were always isolationists at heart. They never had Europe's best interest in mind. Well, they're certainly isolated now. They didn't even send a delegate to the convention. Why should they? They abandoned their space program. The Soviets have cut off almost all their international trade. They have to learn how to adjust their economy to exist on its internal market alone. For America, there is virtually no overseas trade. I haven't even seen an American tourist here in Paris. Have you? It's not the season. No. They're done for. They'll strangle on their own vial. A nation that size can't exist without overseas markets. The United States will self-destruct within another generation, while the Soviets watch and laugh. And the rest of the world? Oh, we go through the motions of being independent. China is still strong, but its missiles are just as obsolete as the Americans against those lasers the Russians have in space. But Europe is rebuilding, along Soviet guidelines. Even Paris is turning into a dull socialist grayness. But the Third World nations are still going their own way. They operate their factories in orbit at Soviet sufferance. And I wonder how long that's going to last. Did you notice the hubbub in the Russian delegation this afternoon? Something is happening. Something big. Moloch did not attend any of today's sessions. He wasn't even at the final plenary meeting. Yes, admitted the young man. That did strike me as odd. Something's in the wind, Kvistikart said gloomily. Something big is about to happen. Chapter 4. The Russians had seized the entire space station. Venezuelan national territory or not, it was now under Soviet control. The captain and the two soldiers watched stolidly as Dan pulled on his coveralls. Then they marched him out of his cabin and down the long, sloping corridor that ran the circumference of the huge revolving wheel. The captain would not answer any of Dan's questions. None of the Russians said a word after the captain had awakened Dan and announced his arrest. They locked Dan in one of the storerooms and marched off out of sight. Alone, Dan looked around at his improvised jail cell. It was a bare little space about the size of two telephone booths put together. Three of its walls were heavy wire mesh, the fourth the curving hull of the station structure, slightly cold to the touch despite its thick layers of insulation. The enclosure had been used to store electronics spare parts, Dan remembered, but the Russians had emptied it completely. Just like them, he thought. The first thing they do is turn something useful into a prison cell. There was nothing at all in the enclosure. No bunk, no bench, nothing but the bare floor and the overhead strip of fluorescent lighting. Looking out through the heavy wire mesh door, Dan saw that the Russians had set up a TV camera in the storeroom on the other side of the narrow walkway that ran the length of the storage area. He grimaced into the camera, hoping that whoever was monitoring him would be startled, at least for a moment. They must have intercepted the flitters, Dan realized. I hope they're treating the crews all right. Their spy system must have been a lot better than I thought. He sank down onto the floor, leaned his back against the stiff metal screen. So ends the illustrious career of the 21st century's premier pirate. It's all over. They'll stuff a sponge rubber ball in my mouth and put a bullet through the back of my head. I'll never see Lucita again. Never have the chance to tell her that I love her. He felt more angry than afraid. Frustrated rather than fearful. His hands were steady, his insides calm. The finality of it was too real, too inescapable. There was nothing left to hope for. But so much to regret, so many things he still wanted to do, so many scores still unsettled. And Lucita. His mind kept coming back to her. He tried to tell himself that it would be better for her this way. He would have brought her nothing but pain and turmoil. Now she could marry the damned Russian and live her life and forget about him. Then he looked down at his hands and saw that they were clenched into fists. He almost laughed aloud. You're not very good at being noble, are you? It was laughable. A cosmic joke. And it was going to end very soon. The Russians would not take any chances. Bang, you're dead. And their problems with space piracy are solved. Their monopoly of space is preserved. The rest of the world gets shown who's boss, with one shot. Lucita. Can it be that I've only known her for less than a year? Funny how time can stretch and contract, how a second can seem as long as infinity, how years can race past and disappear before you realize it. He rested his head against the wire screen and squinted up at the flickering fluorescent tube overhead. The day I met her, the very first day. It was raining. Yes, poured all day. That's the day I met Mollick, too. And Zach Freiberg. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops, Dan quoted under his breath. Then aloud, he grumbled, Damn cold porter. His office window was leaking again. Nothing much, just enough to make an annoying dripping sound and form a soggy puddle in the thick carpeting. The rain teemed down with biblical fury. Dan stood impatiently at the wide, sweeping window of his office and stared out at the downpour. It was as if God were dousing Caracas with a celestial fire hose, pouring torrents of water, solid sheets of it, all over the city. Normally, Dan could see the green hills that rose up beyond the city's boundary and the cable towers for the tramway that went over the mountain to the port at La Guaira, and the wretched squatters' shacks of cardboard and plywood that infested those hills. But not today. He could barely make out Bolivar Square, just a few streets away from his office tower, in the intensity of the downpour. Brand new building, and it leaks like a sieve, he complained to himself. Where the hell's the damned maintenance man? Called him an hour ago. Christ, even in Houston, the service was better than this. His office was on the top floor of the tallest skyscraper in Caracas. It was the office of a man of enormous wealth and power, rich without being garish, imposing without being intimidating. Dan grinned at himself in the faint reflection from the rain-streaked window. At least the roof doesn't leak, he thought. Then he added, not yet. He turned back toward his desk, a bulky, ornate heirloom of Victorian grotesquerie that his great-grandfather had acquired when he had been a young minister in rural Virginia. The office's couches, chairs, and long, polished conference table were all in the ultra-modern Venezuelan style of leather, mahogany, and chrome. The carpets were from India and China. One of them, richly woven with threads of gold, was a gift from his old friend Saito Yamagata. There were no paintings on the walls, but plenty of photographs. None of them were of people. Most showed spacecraft standing on launching platforms. silhouetted against dramatic